But it comes out of your account automatically. You don't see it. It's sort of like, you know, plucking a chicken. You don't really know what's happening. The money is being extracted from your account, but all you see is a net gain or loss.
I think I noticed if someone was plucking a chicken near me.
Yeah.
Living in the city, first off.
Welcome to the Mostly Money Podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
This is Mostly Money, and I'm your host, Preet Banerjee. And on the show today, I'll be speaking with John DeGooey, a full-time writer who dabbles in financial advising on the side, as a joke. his latest book is called Stand Up to the Financial Services Industry, A Practical Guide for Canadians. Now, as usual, before we get started, I wanted to thank the listeners who've left ratings on Apple Podcasts. A special thanks this week to Mostly Manmade, who asked if I could shorten the music on the end of the podcast because they had to wait too long for the next episode to play. So thank you for that feedback. I have made that change a few episodes ago, so hopefully that's working better for you now. Next up, we have Natter B, who also watches my videos on YouTube. And for you listeners out there, if you didn't know, I also have a YouTube. And if you enjoy waiting 5 months between podcast episodes, you are going to love waiting 9 months or more between videos on my YouTube channel. Next, we have Mark23564, who says that the podcast gives good information, but can be a bit long-winded at times, but also notes that that's part of the charm of this conversational format. I don't really know what to make of that. That sounds, I'll take it. I mean, it was a 5-star review, but then there's this sort of like, you know, oh, by the way, it's a bit long-winded. I don't know, it hurts. My guest, John, has brought with him a bottle of scotch. And I have to say, I think this is maybe now the 4th guest in a row that has brought a bottle of scotch. And I'm thinking, yeah, I don't sell ads or make money and monetize the podcast, but man, my scotch cabinet is brimming with some incredible bottles. So, John, thanks very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
And thank you for bringing this wonderful scotch. This is actually my first sip. I haven't had this scotch before. So let's put it to the test, shall we? That is very drinkable. That's going to do some damage.
Good.
Now let's do the official introduction, shall we? John DeGooey is a repeat guest on the show. It was about 2 years ago, which is about 5 episodes, where he was last on to talk about his previous book, The Professional Financial Advisor, 4th edition. And John is a portfolio manager and certified financial planner professional with Wellington Altus Private Wealth in Toronto. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
It has been 2 years. It feels like yesterday, actually, that you were just on. And I really do enjoy our conversations because you're a very interesting fella. You are a financial advisor. You're very vocal within the industry, outside of the industry, appearing in media all over the place. And you're very opinionated. And you have been this way for as long as I've known you. And when I first got into the industry, I remember, and I think I wrote this in the foreword of your previous book, we were at some parties, like the 5-year anniversary of
Advisor's Edge.
Advisor's Edge, that's right. And you made a beeline to me, and you said, you know, you're Preet Banerjee, I've read your stuff, you and I need to stick together. Because at the time, you know, as your book now is fairly adversarial in tone to the industry, I would say, back then, you know, this was relatively new territory compared to the environment today. And so anyways, we've kept in touch and we bounce ideas off each other. We agree most of the time. Sometimes we have disagreements, but we have good discussions and debates. And so I wanted to welcome you back to the show and have you here to talk about your latest book, which is called Stand Up to the Financial Services Industry. Now, tell me a little bit about this book in a nutshell. So the last 4 books were all the same versions of one book, The Professional Financial Advisor, editions 1-4. Is this just edition number 5 and has been repackaged, or is this a totally different book?
A little bit of both. It's the same in that it covers a lot of the same ground in terms of transparency and integrity and professionalism. And being evidence-based. Where it is different is the 4 editions of The Professional Financial Advisor were intended as a bridge between consumers and advisors. I didn't think the two solitudes really understood one another, and I was trying to get them to have a more purposeful conversation with one another. But if you ask me seriously, I would say that the professional financial advisor was really targeted more at advisors to get them to be more professional and transparent. Because they have more or less ignored me, I have decided that, okay, well then in this case, what I have to do is I have to write a book, the new book, expressly for investors to get them to recognize that their advisors are unwittingly biased and they're not trying to screw them over or anything. The subtitle is Protecting Yourself from Well-Intended but Oblivious Advisors. And that's really when I came across a research paper a while ago, and that's what I realized was the problem. Is advisors believe the things that they're recommending, even though the things that they're recommending are demonstrably unlikely to yield positive results. And so advisors, you can't tell someone to change the way they're doing things if they're already convinced that they're doing everything properly. So the four editions of the professional financial advisor didn't land on advisors the way I had hoped, because they were pretty sure they were doing everything properly already, incorrectly, but that's what they thought.
Right.
So now the new book is intended strictly for investors to get them to hopefully confront their misguided advisors to make sure that things are being done properly. And it's a challenge because ordinary investors are at a disadvantage because their advisor will know more than they will. And it's very difficult to hold someone accountable when that person knows more about the subject matter than you do.
Sure. And as we mentioned, I think in the last podcast, Canadians are too damn polite.
Yeah.
Right. And so let's say that you arm them with some knowledge, some checklists to go to your advisor and say, hey, answer this for me, and whatever. So now maybe you have an idea as to what you should be looking for in an advisor. How many of those people are going to then say, all right, well, you know, I'm going to find someone else? I think it's a tough thing.
Right.
There's a lot of people who, once they have established a relationship, there's an inertia that then exists, and leaving that relationship, even when it may not be ideal, is a tough thing to do, whether it's personal relationships or a relationship with professionals. But let's go down this road. So first thing that we want to figure out is, do you believe that all financial advisors are bad?
No, in fact, well, let's put it, there are two things. There's bad and there's badly intended. So there are very few advisors that are crooked or you know, deliberately, willfully sort of roguish. It certainly rounds to zero. It's a small fraction of 1%. So there are very few bad apples in terms of crooks. Mm-hmm. But in terms of advisors that have good intentions, but nonetheless do less than good things, and that's what I'm trying to highlight in the book, is that advisors are, they're well-intended, they're trying to help their clients do well, but they believe things that just aren't true. And so now you're going to an advisor. Most people who work with an advisor do it because they recognize that there's a gap in their own knowledge base. And so they feel that they need the help of a professional who can guide them through whatever vagaries of the financial system that they need to get through. And what they do is they then delegate the responsibility for the decision making to someone who has biases that are as bad or in many cases even worse than their own. And all they're doing is sort of piling on and layering on another layer of fees just to be exposed to the same sort of wives' tales and sort of rules of thumb that don't really work.
Okay, so let's start by looking at what constitutes good financial advice.
Right.
So break that down in a nutshell. What should people be looking for if they're going to be using a financial advisor?
Excellent. And it's funny because you were saying off the top of the podcast that I'm sort of seen as being adversarial. So I'd like to be able to start by saying, here's the positive thing that you should be looking for, because too often I think I lead with the problems. Good advisors are client-centric. So the first thing that you should look for is an advisor who takes a genuine interest in wanting to understand you. Do you have a pension plan? What about your spouse? Do you have a special needs child? Is the marriage in trouble? Well, you know, various things that you would need to know to make sure that he or she can give you advice which is comprehensive, holistic, and suited to your circumstances. I think that would be the first thing that I would look for. The second thing that I would say is, you know, you should check for licensing to make sure what the advisor is allowed to sell, because no matter how good the advice is, when the time comes to actually implement, a person will make recommendations within the universe of products that they're licensed to sell. And so a lot of people will think, for instance, if you wanted to buy individual securities and you see someone who's only licensed to sell mutual funds, that person may be a perfectly good advisor and may be smart and intelligent and all the things that I talked about earlier and client-centric and so forth, but they won't be able to sell you securities because they're not licensed to do so. And unless you ask, it might never come up. And then you'll just work on the assumption that these products are being recommended because that's what's best for you, whereas in fact, it's what's best for you from within the more limited universe of products that the person is licensed to sell.
When you take on new clients and they're presumably interviewing you to see if you're going to be a good fit for their situation, do you find that they will disclose things like, yeah, I'm talking to two other advisors mm-hmm. and I'm really, you know, Most of them do.
Most do. And I think it's a wise thing to do because it makes the advisor more keenly aware that there's a competition going on, so you can't mail it in. Not all do, but and it's not like it's right or wrong, but having said that, I think it's probably better to say it because I think there's full disclosure. If you want to have full disclosure, if the advisor asks the client to say, look, you've got to tell me if you've got this tax bill for 2018 that you still haven't paid, you know, disclose it so that because I don't want to start making recommendations to invest the money when in fact you should be sending that check to CRA, for instance.
Right.
Well, similarly, I think if you're looking at hiring an advisor and you're interviewing two or three other people, you should say, this is what I'm doing. And then perhaps even more importantly, you can be a little more pointed about the questions that you ask and say, look, I want to know, so exactly what services will you provide? Can I get that in writing? What exactly are your fees? Can I get that in writing? And just probe further, because if you can have a good understanding and have it codified and memorialized at the outset, I think there's a less likelihood that you can be surprised down the road.
Let's actually start with giving some takeaways to listeners who may be thinking about taking a new advisor, or maybe they've got questions for their existing channel mm-hmm. of advice, whatever yep. channel that might be. So what are the things that you would recommend to a consumer that they should have on this, you know, this checklist to look for when it comes to, let's say, a financial advisor? We'll focus on the channel of financial advisors. So you're going to a financial advisor. What should you be asking? What should you be looking for?
Let me bring this back then to stand-up, back to the book,
yeah.
because I have about 50 questions in the book, and a lot of them are questions that are not intuitive. Your listeners will likely know that there's a wide variety of advisors in Canada, and they do a lot of things that have pretty good value for most people most of the time, although there are always going to be some exceptions. The problem is the presumption. The presumption is that an advisor is going to work for you the way a doctor would work for you if you said, Doc, I'm not feeling well. The doctors have a Hippocratic oath. They're obligated to do no harm and to try to help you, and they're trying to stay current on the research and to make sure they understand the latest with regard to diet and lifestyle and mortality tables and new drugs and all manner of things. The presumption has long existed that financial advisors think about the way they go about their business the same way, and some of them do. But my experience is that the majority don't. The majority have a license to sell you something, and they go fairly quickly into a product pitch or some way that they can make money, either through fees or commissions. The questions that you therefore have to ask are the ones that will help you to discern the mindset of the advisor. Questions that I like are, what motivates you to look for low-cost products for me? So the advisor, let's say the advisor works on a fee basis and he or she charges 1%. Well, that person can work with securities that cost nothing. They can use products like asset class mutual funds or index funds or exchange traded funds that might cost 30 or 35 basis points, which is about 1/3 of 1%. Or they can use what are called F-class mutual funds, which might cost, say, 1.25 or 1.3%. All three of them are viable products, and all three of them can help you with your investment circumstance. But they have a very different sticker price in terms of what it's going to cost you to own it year over year over year. And the phrase that works, everyone's heard the phrase, a penny saved is a penny earned. The phrase that I like to use in investing is, you get what you don't pay for. In any other line of work, if you're buying a fridge or a computer or a tie or a smartphone, generally speaking, the better products cost more. But in finance, and perhaps only in finance, I have not found another example anywhere else on the planet, the most expensive products are the worst. So in any other line of endeavor, the best products are the most expensive ones. But because product cost eats into your return, and your objective as an investor is to get the highest return possible for the risk that you can tolerate, high cost products are going to get you a lower return. And if the advisor is indifferent to product cost, then he or she is not really doing what would be analogous to a doctor, which is looking out for your best interest. He or she is going to sell something, perhaps because it's easy to sell, and not necessarily because it's what's best for you. So those are the sorts of questions where you have to say, look, I'm not doubting that this is suitable, but suitable is not the same as best. Mm-hmm. What's best? What can you, is there something that's better? Is there something that can help me get to my goal sooner? And if I can take the same amount of risk with, say, 70% in stocks and 30% in bonds, and you know, invest whatever, $7,000 a year for the rest of my life until I'm 65, if I could save myself 0.8% per year and invest the same dollar amount in the same 70-30 mix, but with products that cost 0.8% less, maybe I could retire when I'm 61 or 62. Well, do you think maybe I should be given that as an option? Because if you gave it to me as an option, I'd take it, right? But a lot of clients don't ask for it because they don't realize that it's even one of the possible menu items. So you don't generally ask for things that you don't know exist. And as a result, if the advisor doesn't tell you, you're not going to hear about it. So my advice to your listeners is, there are a whole bunch of questions in the book that will help you to get a better understanding of whether or not your advisor is truly doing what's best for you. And you need to have the courage to ask those tough questions, because nobody's ever going to care more about your money than you. After a while, after you've heard certain things for often enough, you sort of grow an immunity to your getting your sort of spider senses up to say, hey, wait a minute, is that really right? Because if everyone says it's so, well, I guess it must be so. And after a while, then you sort of become insensitive and you just sort of say, oh, and now this becomes the new normal and it becomes established. And then people start failing to challenge presumptive orthodoxy, even when there are things that are being presumed that are demonstrably wrong that you can disprove very quickly. So here's my example. One of the things, and I do a TV program called Market Call on BNN every few weeks. And one of the phrases that I have heard other guests use when they're doing an interview is they'll say, it's a stock picker's market.
Right, yeah.
And you need to understand that whenever a stock is traded, there's a buyer and a seller. And if the buyer is the winner in the trade, that means the seller was the loser. It's a binary 50-50 proposition. It's zero sum before costs and negative sum after costs, because you're going to be paying transaction charges and possibly some capital gains taxes when you transact stocks. But the presumption is that this is a market where the stock picker will be able to deliver superior performance, which is to say outperformance relative to a benchmark. But the fact of the matter is, the two people that are trading that security that I just talked about a moment ago are both stock pickers. And if you're going to give credit to the one that outperforms, then it logically follows that you have to ascribe blame to the one that underperforms.
So it's a good stock picker's market.
So yeah, it's like saying, it's like a lottery picker's numbers market,
right?
Like, you know, well, yeah, as long as you pick the right numbers, you're going to do fine. But there's no reason to think that you will.
Right. And I think this, where I see this being echoed is when we talk about outperformance in down markets. And someone will say, well, you know, it's easier to outperform in a down market, but it's the same opportunity set. And right. If you go back to Sharpe's paper that mm-hmm. he put out, you know, that 5-page white paper talking about the arithmetic of active management, and he says, listen, you know, you put all the active investors into one room, essentially, and they are the market. And you put all the people who are just tracking the market into another room, well, they get the market return too. And really, the only difference in aggregate is the cost of the people in these two different rooms. And that kind of applies if it's markets going up, down, sideways, et cetera.
Inflation, deflation, monetary easing, monetary tightening, inflation, deflation, good jobs, bad jobs. It doesn't matter. It's always true.
So that one debunked.
Debunked, yeah.
All right, and next. What do you have next on your list?
What else would I...
Let me give you one. This is one of my bugaboos.
Okay.
There are more sellers today than buyers.
Yeah, buyers, yeah. But by definition, if 100 shares of XYZ stock are sold, then 100 were sold and 100 were bought by the person that was selling them, from the person that was selling them. So there may be more people that are motivated to sell or more people that are motivated to buy, but the absolute number of shares being transacted is always the same whether you're a buyer or a seller. It's funny because it's just human nature. It's so seductive to want to be able to outperform. Everyone thinks if we just try harder, we can outperform. It's like quicksand. You know, the more you try to get out of quicksand, the more you sink. Well, similarly, the more money you spend trying to outperform the market, the more likely you are to underperform simply because you're spending more money and effort and time trying.
The other thing I wanted to say that gets me about that statement that there are more sellers than buyers today, and this is sloppy to me. I hear this all the time in the media. When the market goes down, automatically people just say, oh, yeah, there was more sellers than buyers. It's technically possible for the market to go down and there be fewer actual number of sellers than buyers, because if, let's say, Warren Buffett was the only person selling and everyone else was buying but at a lower price, then technically there were more buyers than that one guy selling.
You could have one person selling a million shares, and you could have
a million people buying.
You can have 1,000 people buying 10,000, selling, buying 10,000 shares each. The point that I would make to your listeners is that I wrote this book because I realized there was a paper that came out in 2016 called The Misguided Beliefs of Financial Advisors. And I realized that my writing to advisors to get them to be more professional and transparent and evidence-based was falling on deaf ears because advisors were sure they had it right. Mm-hmm. So the paper shows that advisors overwhelmingly chase past performance, run concentrated positions, and are indifferent to product cost. And this is advisors in general, writ large. And this is American researchers using Canadian advisors as part of their sample size. And there were thousands of advisors in the sample size. So it's extremely robust and statistically significant. What that then means is advisors, and they show that advisors don't just do this, but they do it even after they've retired, which is to say, it's not like they have an ulterior motive. They're not trying to get you to buy something. They're not buying something to say, well, I buy this myself. They trade like this even after they've left the industry, even when they have no sort of possible bias-inducing horse in the race that would cause them to do things otherwise. They do it because they honestly believe it. So it's a perverse kind of problem that we have here. And this is a problem that, is, to the best of my knowledge, has not really sort of reached the consciousness of investors until very, very recently. And that is, you're going to an advisor on the presumption that he or she is going to help steer you in the right direction. But if he or she has biases as well, they might actually be reinforcing your own biases. They might be aiding and abetting. They might be piling on. They might be doubling down on things that are destructive and counterintuitive, and they might be doubling down because they're trying to help you. So they'll be chasing past performance, which is to say they're stock picking or fund picking, even though every study, there have been like 10 studies that have shown over the past 30 years that past performance may not be repeated and should not be relied upon. It's on every prospectus and every fund facts I have ever seen in my more than 25 years in the business. Everyone knows it. It's sort of trite. It's sort of like a speed limit, though. It says it's you can't do more than 100 on the 401, but everyone does more than 100 on the 401. You can put a disclaimer on the prospectus saying past performance may not be repeated and shouldn't be relied upon, but people are still going to rely on it because they think it's going to be repeated. And right. It's madness. If good advisors should be disabusing his or her client of things that are demonstrably untrue, but they don't, because they want to position themselves as being the expert, and they position themselves as being uniquely qualified to find those funds that will outperform in the future. So they don't disabuse the client of their erroneous notion because it's good for them to do business. It allows them to, it sets themselves up for a value proposition to justify their existence when in fact they can't substantiate it. But investors think that the advisor can pick the funds, and therefore the advisor continues to maintain the shell game that he can pick the funds, even though there's absolutely no evidence anywhere that anybody can do this reliably over time.
Is it fair to say that we're starting to see a shift?
Sure.
When we take a look at, mutual funds are in net redemptions.
Yeah.
And exchange traded fund assets, the growth rates are high. Right. Yeah. And so the ratio is still quite sizable.
10 to 1, yeah.
But is it fair to say that things are starting to change?
It's certainly fair to say they're starting to change. And depending on, who you talk to, the glass is either half full or half empty. I'm actually, ironically, in the half empty camp. The good news is, from where we were, say, 20 years ago, it was 100% mutual funds and 0% ETFs, and now it's 90% mutual funds and 10% exchange-traded funds. And so people will say, well, over the past generation, there's been a significant shift, sort of in air quotes, significant shift toward ETFs. If you think 10% over a generation is significant, then I guess the answer is sure. But I would say that if it was truly significant over the course of a generation, it would be 35 or 40 or 45%. Certainly in the US, it's been much more significant than it has been in Canada. So the shift is underway and Canada is slow to adapt. And I think that slowness is part and parcel with the entrenchment of the industry, and people are just too damn polite. And so as a result, sacred cows that are presumptively true are continue to exist, and people get away with saying things that are demonstrably untrue because nobody ever stops and takes a step back and said, well, wait a minute, is that really true? Or is that just something that I've just heard so many times because people believe things after they get repeated? Or is there actual evidence that will actually refute that? And it seems no one, neither investors nor advisors, is really stepping back and saying, okay, first principles, what are we trying to do here? What really works? What is demonstrably effective? So the example that I love to use all the time is that in 1964, the US Surgeon General came out with a report showing that cigarettes cause cancer. That's 55 years ago. And ironically, some of the papers with regard to past performance not persisting and so forth started coming out 50 years ago. And yet, we've recognized, although it took us at least a generation, but we've recognized in the first 20 or 25 years that, geez, I guess cigarette smoke really does cause cancer. And a lot of doctors were caught in the net because they themselves were smokers. I think I saw the statistics that something like 40% of Americans and 50% of American doctors were smokers when this paper came out. And so now the people who are supposed to be part of the solution, the doctors, are not only not part of the solution, but they are actively contributing to the problem. They're part of the problem. So it's difficult to get the doctor, the professional intermediary who's making the recommendation, to change his or her own behavior, because up until now they've been saying, well, Mrs. Jones, you can trust me, I'm your doctor. I wouldn't do anything to harm you. And these cigarettes are totally fine. They're harmless. I've been smoking Camels for the past 15 years or whatever. Well, now when the Surgeon General says, well, actually, no, these Camels and these Marlboros and these whatever else cause cancer, the doctor has to stop, reassess, and say the things that I thought were true because I was naive, because I didn't know the evidence, because the evidence didn't exist previously. Now that there's new evidence, it behooves me, it's incumbent upon me as the intermediary that people are coming to make lifestyle recommendations that will be healthy, that I tell them, look, Joe, you got to stop smoking. This is going to kill you if you don't stop. And again, it's one of those things where it's, the phrase is normative optimality. It's the sort of thing that usually works most of the time on a balance of probabilities basis. So there will always be exceptions. There will be people like Churchill who smoked until they were 90 and didn't get cancer. And there are people who never smoked a day in their life. Mario Lemieux was a smoker, actually, but not a good example, but he was a world-class athlete who got cancer in his 20s. And so you can, there are exceptions in both directions, but the causation is not in dispute anymore. Cigarette smoke causes cancer. There's a correlation. Well, it hasn't been in dispute for 50 years that product cost correlates negatively with performance. The more products cost, the worse they perform. And yet the very, very large majority of advisors, and I would say virtually all of mutual fund advisors that I come across in Canada, act as though that's not the case. Let me give you an example of why I believe that to be true. Mutual fund advisors like to tell stories. Everyone likes to tell stories. The phrase that I use is that people who rationalize tell rational lies. They say things that are plausible, but if you check under the hood, it's demonstrably not true. So when you ask a mutual fund registrant what they think about exchange traded funds, they'll say, well, I don't like them because I believe in active management. So a couple of things. Number one, they don't like them because they're not licensed to sell them. So you couldn't, most MFDA registrants could not sell you an ETF if their life depended upon it because they're not licensed to do so. Problem number one, but that's not what they say. Problem number two, there are some mutual funds that are passive and some ETFs that are active. So it's a bit of a overly facile sort of throwaway to say that you believe in active. And then they don't care about cost, and cost is the most important determinant of your long-term performance, far, far more than past performances. So the way I like to test it is, okay, well, about a year ago, Vanguard came out with a suite of low-cost, actively managed mutual funds. So you would think that these mutual fund registrants who say they believe in active management, who don't have any kind of a axe to grind with regard to whether they're licensed to sell the product, they're unambiguously licensed to sell mutual fund products, you would think that they would be using these really good, low-cost, actively managed Vanguard mutual funds. But they're not. And why? Because the big bugaboo is advisors like embedded compensation. They like to get paid via trailing commission. So if the product doesn't pay a trailing commission, it doesn't matter how good the product is. The advisor's just not going to recommend it. So there's the story. And then there's the reality of what's going on here. And you as the investor are going to be given a story, but you need to be able to ask the follow-up questions to say, well, wait a minute, sort of be like Columbo, you know, one more question as you're walking out the door. You said that you believed in active management. Yeah. You said that you believed in client choice. Yeah. You said you're licensed to sell mutual funds. Yeah. Well, why can't I have this Vanguard mutual fund? And the advisor will probably give you a story, but the advisor will probably either not tell you about their desire to work on commission, or they'll make something else up, or they'll deflect, but not really talk about the real issue. But the fact of the matter is, the very large majority of MFDA registrants, mutual fund salespeople, are making product recommendations based on their preferred business model, not based on the products that are best for their clients. I cannot begin to tell you how many advisors have said that they want to keep embedded compensation trailing commissions, because if they were to be done away with, there would be an advice gap. There would be all these investors in Canada that would not have access to financial advice. And it's sort of like, okay, so you're at a Coke machine. There are two people at a Coke machine. One person, it's $2 for a Coke. One person has a toonie and the other person has two loonies. Who can better afford the Coke? It's the same $2. It's just how you pay. But the quantum of payment, which is to say the affordability, is unchanged. So whether you pay through a 1% trailing commission or you give the client a bill for 1%, it's equally affordable. But I've heard dozens of advisors, product manufacturers, industry associations who come forward with this hogwash of, well, we can't get rid of embedded compensation because there will be an advice gap. No, we can easily get rid of embedded compensation. There will not be an advice gap. You just don't want to get rid of embedded compensation because it aids and abets your selling high cost, high margin products, which are good for you and your firm, but not so good for the end user investor. A lot of people that are currently working with advisors will, over time, slide over to robos. So, you know, today we're at maybe 20% do it yourself. Maybe 1% robo and 79% working with an advisor. I think the people that are do-it-yourselfers are going to stay at around 20%, but that 79% advisor and 1% robo is going to go down to maybe 60-20 or maybe even 50-30. 50-30 might take a generation or two, but you know, in the fullness of time, I think, and especially as robos get better and as artificial intelligence gets better, I don't want to have to compete against robos in 20 years, but I'm only going to be doing this for the next 12 or 15 years, and so I'm not going to have to worry about it so much. But artificial intelligence keeps on getting better, and disintermediation and disruption that comes from technology, robos put bank tellers out of work 30 years ago. They put taxi drivers sort of kind of out of work, you know, 5 years ago, and everything in between and everything going forward. There's a whole bunch of people, truck drivers, that are going to be disintermediated. Lawyers, doctors. It's the sort of thing where before long we can pee in a cup or spit in a vial and have it sent to a lab and have it tested, and you can get more quickly and far, far more accurately diagnosed if you have a problem than you could with a human. I think the future for most of the professions is cyborg, where you have the analysis done by the robot, which is artificially intelligent, and then the interface, the sort of bedside manner, which is done by the human.
Interesting. I think it would be a really good takeaway for the listeners to very quickly break down the different models of advice out there, just to give people the landscape, because it can be very confusing for people not inside the industry.
Sure.
There's a lot of jargon out there. So let's start with traditional commission-based advice. How does that work?
Okay, so I would say that in the securities business, maybe 35 or 40% of brokers, people who have a license to sell stocks and bonds, still do so on a commission basis. The majority is fee-based, but there are still a bunch of people that will charge you whatever, $125 or $200 a trade, depending on the number of shares and the typical price of the security to trade. And they'll charge you to sell it, and they'll charge you to buy something with the proceeds. So it's the sort of thing where it's based on the traditional model of trading, which has been, as we've shown over the course of this interview, largely discredited. But it can be effective if you are the sort of person who owns like 15 or 20 stocks and you trade one or two of them annually, and you just keep the other, you know, 14 for next year or the year after. So you only do one or two transactions, and you pay perhaps handsomely for the transaction, but the total cost will still be lower, and it will be relatively tax effective. And as long as you're okay with the underlying holdings, because you're going to be having some concentration risk and some home bias risk, and, you know, just risks of lack of diversification in general. But if you're okay with that, that'll be okay.
And presumably that's for larger portfolios, because if you have $10,000 in 14 different...
You're right. You're not going to do that.
You're probably not going to find someone who's going to take that on. Right.
And then similarly, I'm going to put people who work on commission with mutual funds in that group as well. So you could have, say, $250,000 in mutual funds, and your advisor might say, here's five mutual funds, and we'll put $50,000 into each mutual fund, and it will pay me a trailing commission, which will be deducted from your account. And typically the stock funds will maybe pay a 1% commission, and the bond funds might pay, say, 0.5% commission. So if it's three stock funds and two bond funds, then the advisor might be paid, I think the math is going to be 0.8% per year on the assets. And if your assets go up, then it'll be 0.8% on more than $250,000. And if the assets go down, it'll be on less. But it comes out of your account automatically. You don't see it. It's sort of like, plucking a chicken. You don't really know what's happening. The money is being extracted from your account, but all you see is a net gain or loss.
I think I noticed if someone was plucking a chicken near me.
Yeah.
Living in the city, first off.
It was a metaphor. Somebody once said that the idea of taxation is to take off as many feathers with the minimum amount of hissing. And so it's the same sort of thing, is that mutual funds that pay trailing commissions, the reason advisors like them is because they don't generally have conversations with their clients about how much they're paying. But the problem, of course, that engenders is that high-cost products are joined at the hip with embedded compensation. So the ones that have the least of a reason for the advisor to talk to the investor about how much the investor's paying the advisor in his or her firm, also, as by virtue of paying them that way, are generally using the highest cost products. And so it's easy for the advisor to get paid, but it's bad for the client to be paying the most. And you can see there's a mismatch of priorities here. There's not an alignment here. What you'd want to have is you'd want to have the advisor to be trying to look for the lowest cost products for the client and still charge fairly and pass those savings on so the client can get further along. So that would be the commission model.
Yeah. So we'll just break that down. So the commission model, you're either paying a commission to buy and sell individual securities, or commissions are being generated by virtue of embedded compensation inside the product cost.
Right.
All right. So that's commissions. Right. Next, let's talk about what's referred to in the industry as fee-based.
Okay. So that's the way I work.
Yeah.
So a fee-based advisor will charge you a fee based on the amount of money that you're managing. So I'll use my fee schedule because I'm familiar with it. It's easy to understand. I charge 1.4% on the first $250,000. Then everything between $250,000 and $1.5 million, I charge 0.8%. And everything over $1.5 million, I charge 0.5%. So it's a sliding scale. So if you know what a marginal tax rate is, you know that as you make more money, you're paying disproportionately more money and you're paying more money in tax as a higher percentage of your income that you earn. Similarly, it works the same way, only in reverse, with the assets that you're managing. It's not four times as much work to manage $1 million portfolio as it is to manage $250,000 portfolio. And therefore, most people would intuitively agree that it ought not cost four times as much. So using the formula of 1.4% on the first $250,000, 0.8% on everything between $250,000 and $1.5 million, you get to 1% at $750,000. So at $750,000, you're paying 1%, which is $7,500 a year. Now, for that, you're getting discretionary portfolio management, trading, rebalancing, a written investment policy statement, all planning situations in terms of the use of Money Gaff software, all manner of things to help you.
Oh, sorry. I forgot that our conversations now require a conflict of interest disclosure. John is technically a client of my company, Money Gaff.
So there you go.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where a good advisor can help with integrating a whole manner of related concerns. So you have to know family law, and you have to sort of help people with possibly dealing with a divorce. And do you have a will in place? What about a power of attorney for personal care and for property? Do you have insurance? Yeah. Okay. Is it the right amount? Is it the right kind? You start having these more involve conversations that will sort of help the advisor to put his or her arms around the client and be their personal CFO and help them through all financial matters as they go through the entire life cycle. They might have a corporation. What are we going to do there? Can we put a buy-sell agreement in place with your partner? All manner of things.
Now, let's take a step back. So what you've described is kind of like your process, right?
Right.
So that is not necessarily aligned with a fee-based model. Because it is possible to have someone charging you a percentage of assets and just
nothing,
managing the portfolio.
And do nothing other than just
So it's important to separate out the cost structure and
the
services
service being
structure.
Offered. We agree.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the problem that you and I have when we talk to people and when we write books, is because the industry is not homogenous. There are many nuances and shades of gray. And so strictly speaking, you're exactly correct. Fee-based just means that you're going to charge a fee based on the quantum of assets being managed. But the services that you provide as part of that fee vary greatly. And from a whole lot to pretty much nothing other than just managing the money.
And what makes this particularly difficult is from the layperson, the financial consumer who is approaching someone and they're saying, hey, look, I charge, I use a fee-based model. Right. And I'm not only going to manage, say, the portfolio, I'm also going to do all these other services. The problem is you can have a lot of people in that bucket and all those other services can be totally different. And mm-hmm. some people will say, well, hey, look, I also look at insurance. Whereas others might say, well, I do a full financial planning process and it's front loaded and there's a review process and we take a look at estate planning and this, that, and the other. But I think for the average consumer, they're going to just say, all right, there's investment only, there's investment plus some of those services, but they may not know what is the full menu of services that could be available. And I think that just serves to confuse people more. Because there is this lack of standardization that exists in the industry. Because a lot of financial advisors are basically entrepreneurial in that they are set up to run their own practice almost as they see fit within certain regulatory requirements. But beyond that, the portfolio of services that they offer is not regulated. So they could offer some, they could offer a lot. And again, there's no way to really delineate that if you're a consumer, which is why I have to spend a lot of time researching what you should be looking for in a financial advisor. The next compensation model that we'll talk about, the retainer model.
Right.
So that's more popular in the United States. Again, everything's about 5 years ahead in terms of technology, models, et cetera. So explain what a retainer model would look like in Canada right now.
There are basically two ways that you can pay an advisor on retainer. You can do it on an hourly basis the way you would for a lawyer, or you can do it on based on deliverables. So let's say I want you to write a full comprehensive financial plan, and the financial plan costs $1,500, whether it takes 2 hours or 20 hours to write it. It's the sort of thing where, and some advisors do one or the other, some mix and match depending on the clients and the specialization. And again, even that is not universal, because a lot of people that are fee only retainer based advisors might also be CAs. They might do tax returns. They might do other things like that, and others might not. And it's very difficult. So you have to ask questions and just make sure you know what you're getting. But I would say that the retainer model is likely the most professional in terms of being unbiased and unconflicted. And I think there are some very, very smart retainer-based advisors in Canada, but it's almost like you can count them on your hands. I think there's maybe between 100 and 200 advisors that do this in Canada, out of compared to 100,000 that are licensed to sell products. So it still rounds to zero as a percentage of the entire advisor population, but they're out there.
And I think that that number, I think that sounds about right based on the last that I've heard, somewhere around 100 to 200 who are doing pure retainer.
Yep.
But it is now, what I've noticed is that there are some advisors who are looking to add a retainer option to their current structure. So, you know, some fee-based advisors, because there are a lot of households where they make good money, but they don't necessarily have the asset thresholds that they need to be taken on by some of these fee-based advisors. Maybe they don't have 250,000. Maybe they don't even have 100,000. Maybe they don't even have 25,000 in a portfolio yet, but they still need planning. And so I'm finding that there are more and more advisors who are saying, all right, well, if they don't meet, like they don't have investable assets, we'll offer these people the retainer model, because there's still a service being provided and people are still willing to pay for that service, just they can't pay through the portfolio because they don't have one.
All of which is true. And that's one of the travesties in the marketplace, is that sometimes that there are people out there who want advice and need advice and are prepared to pay for it, but they can't get it using the conventional channel. Part of why I have a lot of respect for fee-only retainer-based advisors is because many of them are among the smartest advisors I know. And yet many of them are making less money than the less able commission-based or fee-based advisors, asset-based fee-based advisors, because it's a smaller market. So it's a bit of a mismatch that I think as a meritocracy, a lot of fee-based advisors are very, very good. I haven't seen a lot of people that are currently working as charging a fee based on assets like I do that are adding a retainer sort of side gig. There are probably a handful, but not many. I think that might change as regulations change and as technology improves. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see that number jump from, you know, next to nothing to maybe having 200, 300, 400 advisors that will be both fee-based, based on assets, and retainer-based, charging a certain dollar amount based on doing certain things separate from. And maybe what you can do is you can have a hybrid where you can say, I'm going to charge a lower asset base based on the assets that I'm managing. And then you can decide whether you want these additional services or not. And if you want them, they're going to pay for them. And maybe the advisor will make more than if they're sort of combined in one like this. Or the advisor will have less overhead and will do less work and be paid less money. But that's okay, because you're going to have staff and other expenses, and maybe you can do it that way. And again, I think the driver of when that fulcrum shifts is likely to be technology, because the more you can offload to technology, the more you can leverage that and become profitable at a lower dollar amount.
You've recently been appointed chair of FP Canada's Research Foundation Board. So tell me more about what that is.
So I've been on the board for 2 years already. This is my third year on the board.
And maybe explain what FP Canada is.
So FP Canada is the recently rebranded, formerly known as the Financial Planning Standards Council. So these are the people who confer the CFP mark. So it's a certification body that represents certified financial planners across the country, of which there are over 17,000. And the Research Foundation is a foundation that was set up maybe, I don't know, half dozen years ago, give or take, that does research, applied research into financial planning in Canada for Canadians. So where there has been just a small mountain of research with regard to stock trading and finding ways to improve risk-adjusted returns and yada, 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 about portfolio management, because there's a market for that because everybody's trying to find a way to get a leg up. There has been virtually no research until very recently in Canada with regard to financial planning. And for most ordinary retail Canadians, that's a bit of a shame because a lot more value can be added by doing financial planning work than can be by trying to find ways to gain the market. But up until very recently, there was very little research done. So the mandate of the research foundation is to help Canadian academics mostly do research that can be applied by CFP practitioners, but by financial planners anywhere to help improve the lives of their clients by learning best practices and things that work best. Again, normative optimality, things that on a balance of probabilities yield a better result, all else being equal, so that we can actually have a body of research in Canada. And we're still a bit of a world leader. The best research in financial planning is being done by the Americans, but the stuff that they do is really esoteric and not the sort of stuff that you can apply. So the foundation board is really trying hard to provide a mandate and to provide a vehicle to find, to fund research that can be applied right away to help give advice that sticks, to make sure that, you know, when you give advice, what can we do to close the feedback loop to make sure that the advice is actually taken, as an example, you know, best practices, you know, when do you take your CPP, you know, and there's, you know, research that can be done. And then the first derivative question is, well, if most of the research shows that it's better to take it later rather than sooner, why are so many people taking it sooner? So that's the sort of stuff that we do. It's fun, and I'm really excited about it because it's applied. It's sort of who I am because I've spent my entire career championing evidence and championing planning as a value add for retail clients. And this is a way that I can sort of give back and sort of have fun doing things that I would have been doing anyway.
Very good. All right. Now, there was one more question I have for you. And that is talking about the intersection of planning and advice, mm-hmm. and especially portfolio management. So what do you see as being a possible deficiency about how planners are working today? Because we've had conversations about this before, yeah. and you know where I'm leading with this.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I've done some work. There's another committee that reports every year for FP Canada that does that produces a document called the Assumptions Guidelines for FP Canada and IQPF, which is the Quebec equivalent with regard to the regulation of CFP registrants in Canada. And the guidelines are very clear with regard to the return assumptions that planners should be using when they help their clients project whether or not they'll have enough money when they retire and whether that money will last for the rest of their lifetime using prudent assumptions for life expectancy. And one of the things that I have found is that, A, most people are not CFPs, so they don't use any kind of a guideline at all. They're not even aware of guidelines. Many CFP registrants don't necessarily use the guidelines. But even those people that use the guidelines, my experience is the very large majority don't use them properly. And here's why. The guidelines make it very clear that what we talked about a couple of times already in this podcast is true. The expected return is the return of an asset class or of a benchmark minus the cost associated with it. Cost is a reliable determinant of performance. So let's say the long-term expected return of the TSX is 6.8%. Let's say. I don't know. Okay, well, 6.8% is a long-term expected return. The TSX doesn't have an MER, doesn't have expenses. The TSX doesn't charge advisory fees. So if you're using a mutual fund to get access to Canadian stocks and that mutual fund costs 2.3%, then you should, as a reputable planner, be projecting a return expectation of 4.5% because the market does 6.8. The product that you're using to get access to the market costs 2.3. 6.8 minus 2.3 is 4.5. Virtually no one is doing this. And so we have an entire generation of Canadians where the majority of people are not getting plans being done to actually determine whether or not they're likely to have enough money when they retire. But almost all the ones that are getting it done are whistling past the graveyard because they're expecting their returns to be higher than they're going to be because their professional advisor is not doing a proper job because they're not taking cost into consideration.
If you're forgetting about costs in your planning projections and in the real world, those costs have an impact. Yeah. Then it's a bit of a disservice because you are producing a plan that is basically useless.
And that's correct. And another thing that I would say is if you are indifferent toward cost and therefore as an advisor not even trying to use low-cost products, let's say that you... One way that you could actually hold an advisor accountable is to say, oh, do you do projections? You know, can you do these projections for me? And then say, well, do these projections take into account cost? Well, no, they don't. Well, can you rerun them with the numbers? And then can you just rerun them one more time to see what my returns would be like if we use low-cost products? So you can see I would have $2.8 million. And if I take the product cost into account, it'll be $1.9 million. And if I just substituted low-cost products for high-cost products for printing low-cost products where the previous high-cost products existed, I might be getting $2.3 million. Well, I mean, the bad news is it's $500,000 less than I thought the other way. But the good news is it's still $400,000 more than I would have had. And all I had to do was get rid of high-cost products and substitute low-cost products. If you're young enough and your savings rate is like, it's the sort of thing where it's not a stretch to have a substantial six-digit delta, well over $100,000, in many cases, $200,000-$400,000 difference, just by lowering your cost by 0.75%. And it's very doable.
So people will read your book and they'll be able to become financial advisor advisors. And... And tell their advisors, listen, here's how you should be doing your job.
Yeah, they'll sort of like be the financial advisor sheriffs. I mean, the problem is too many people just work on the assumption that their advisor has got their back. And the advisor, the point that I cannot stress enough is advisors are well-intended. They are not trying to screw their clients. They just don't know any better. They honestly believe that cost doesn't matter, even though the evidence is really clear that it does, mm-hmm. as one example.
Right. And I think just so that people are clear, you do believe that there are good advisors.
There are many.
You're an advisor yourself, so presumably you would think that you're a good advisor.
Right.
So you're well-intended.
Well-intended, but also self-aware, because many of the advisors that are well-intended are not self-aware.
Right. So again, you are of the opinion that, yes, there are great advisors out there. You just have to do a lot more digging to find them.
Right.
Excellent. John, thank you so much for being on the show. Before we go, you've got your commercial to tell people about the book, where they can find it. Floor is yours.
Okay, so the book is available in bookstores across the country. Stand Up to the Financial Services Industry. Protecting yourself from oblivious but well-intended from well-intended but oblivious advisors. And on Amazon and bookstores across the country, I've built a website, which is www.standup.today, where you can find maybe six or seven of the most important bits of research that you can actually read yourself, but actually maybe print out and shove under your advisor's nose to hold him or her accountable when they start telling you things that they think are true, which are actually not true. Including the assumptions guidelines we just talked about a moment ago, but also reports from Standard & Poor's, their index versus active, showing that the very large majority of actively managed products underperform, and so forth. I have my own website for my own practice at Wellington Altus, which is www.standupadvisors.com. And that's available, and you can reach me. You can follow me on Twitter, which is at @standup_today. And you can call me at my office, which is 416-369-1502.
For the people who use phones. I hate phones. I absolutely hate phones. But hey, maybe someone will give you a call. John, thank you so much for coming on the show. But more importantly, thank you so much for the bottle of scotch.